My aim tonight is to very briefly recap what we talked about last week, what I in particular talked about, which was a lot, and then open it up for some discussion about sort of the themes that were brought out last time, as well as anything else you want to talk about. And I think one thing I would like to do, partly based on a suggestion I think that Tom had made, at least is to experiment with it, you know, maybe initially once a month, and maybe we'll get into a regular rhythm of which meeting in the month, like the first Wednesday of the month. We'll just use it as kind of more of a free-for-all. Questions about practice, current concerns, you know, how do we apply practice to our everyday life and all the rest of that. So we'll see a little bit tonight how it goes. Okay? So to reset, last week, and I should say that for the recording, that today is what, August 11th, right, 2010. I got into two main points. The first was to make a distinction that was deliberately a little provocative, but still actually quite genuine on my part, between, on the one hand, what I called Buddhism light, and I'm not the only person who's used that term, and on the other hand, the reading that I gave of the Heartwood Sutta of the Buddha, where he distinguished between people who aim for the twigs and leaves of practice, or the outer bark, or the inner bark, or even the sapwood, from those who stay after the heartwood itself, and distinguish the heartwood from those other things. Not that there's anything wrong with the twigs and the leaves, or the outer bark, the inner bark, and the sapwood, but they're not the heartwood, which is what he called an unshakable deliverance of mind, which I think in maybe more Western terms is a sense of a kind of unconditional, steady well-being, open-heartedness, non-reactivity, insight, and freedom, regardless of conditions. Okay. On the one hand, Buddhism light, I think, is a kind of focus on good stuff, being calmer and nicer. And there's a lot to be said for being calmer and nicer rather than upset and mean, right? Not to knock, calmer and nicer. And yet, I think that is not the same as what the Buddha taught as the ultimate aim of practice. Okay. So right there, that's a big topic. What does that actually mean for each person in this room? The second thing I did was to point out that if we were interested in the heartwood, one of the things that was critically important was to deal with the desires that got us into trouble. And the Buddha spent a lot of time talking about the desires that get us into trouble. I described those desires in terms of three categories related to the three fundamental motivational systems in the human brain that have evolved over time. One system being to avoid what's unpleasant, another system being to approach what's pleasant, and a third system, which uses the other two for its ends, to attach to us and you know, deal with them, but especially to bond with, to attach to us. And so there are ways to operate those three systems that lead to happiness for our and benefit for ourselves and others. And there are ways to operate with those three systems in terms of desires that get us into trouble and cause harm to others. So we explored what some of those desires might be to make it more real, right? Like, for example, overeating or just indulging in emotional reactions or pursuing goals to a fault or inhibiting oneself from really reaching for the stars or reaching for other people. Those are all desires that get us into trouble in the real world of our life. So it's worth thinking, what are the desires of all kinds that get you into trouble in your own real life? And I've spent a fair amount of time in the last week or two thinking about that myself. And then we talked about how, in the Buddha's model, to work with that. And I used his framing of what he called the gratification, the danger, and the escape. All right? The gratification in the desires that get us into trouble are often short-term rewards, immediate gratifications, or the hope or anticipation of a gratification, of some kind of reward. That's the gratification. And if we don't admit to the gratification, if we don't tell the truth about the gratification, we're just, then we get hijacked willy-nilly. The second thing is to see the danger in the desire that gets into trouble, us in trouble. The danger in terms of the results of the desire, but actually the more fundamental and far-reaching danger in the experiencing of the desire itself. Right? So that's something as well that's a danger, because very often in the experiencing of the desire, which involves craving, there's a kind of embedded anxiety about whether we'll get it or not. There's an embedded separation of self from world, very often in the experiencing and the basic activation of desire. Is there not? That's suffering right there. There is also often a kind of stressful activation of the body-mind in the desiring itself that lights up stress systems, sends cortisol and other stress hormones to the body, makes the heart beat faster. Right? Very often in the desiring itself, again, the danger in the process itself is that we tend to narrow in on that which we desire and lose that wide open, spacious awareness of everything, which includes a sense of connection with everything. These are examples of dangers in desiring itself, in addition to the prices we pay for pursuing the desires that get us into trouble. And then last, we talked about the escape. How in the world can we become freer or completely free of particular desires or even desiring in general that gets us into trouble? How can we actually do that? And I went through some of the methods the Buddha has laid out and some of my own thoughts about that as well. They included having a prior sense of fullness, which built on the previous week, not last week, but the week prior, where we talked about gratitude. Gratitude in the sense of prior fullness is a wonderful way to kind of, you know, do a preemptive strike, if you'll forgive the warlike metaphor, the martial metaphor, against desiring, which very often comes from a sense of not having enough, right? Wanting more, needing to be filled. All right, so that's a recap. And that's a lot of material, isn't it? So I wanted to open it up here to see what, and we didn't have much time last time for discussion. So I wanted to open it up. You know, what are your thoughts about desires that get you into trouble? What questions might you have about the Buddha's structure of seeing the gratification, the danger, and the escape? By the way, he said that one who does not completely see the gratification, the danger, and the escape in worldly life, ordinary ways of approaching living, is not enlightened. It's only when someone fully and completely sees, you know, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, that they're truly liberated from suffering. So he really emphasized this as a very, very important thing. Okay? All right. So what are your own thoughts or questions or comments about any or all of this stuff? Yeah, please.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same.
Yeah, and I'm being.
You have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
And I guess the problem, no, I didn't have a problem, but the thing that I noticed about the story of the Heartwood is that unless you were already at the Heartwood or you're at the Heartwood, everything else isn't as good, which made me feel kind of bad because I'm miles away from the Heartwood. So all we can do is strive, but striving at the twigs is just as valuable as striving somewhere else along the path. You're striving. Would you not say?
It's wonderful stuff. And so I think you're getting it, honestly, one reason why in my own personal encounter, see, my encounter with this Dharma, with Buddhism, was funny. I started with the Heartwood, my own story. You know, when I was a senior in, I never told you this, actually, I think. When I was a senior at UCLA, my very last quarter, I had 12 units, and I could do independent study because I had fulfilled my requirements. So for some really no clear reason whatsoever, I actually think for me it's some kind of evidence perhaps of grace, I don't know. But unaccountably, it just occurred to me as a very conventional kind of guy from with a conventional background, gee, I should look into Eastern philosophy and religion. So I did 12 units on that, and I just dropped into the radical teaching of Zen and the communication of Alan Watts, you know, about the taboo against, you know, knowing who you really are, and a whole bunch of other kinds of things. And I just kind of got it, really. Wow, we really are all one, you know? So I kind of started there, right? And then after a lot of wandering and kind of losing track, I came back into practice probably about, in a really firm way, probably around 15 years ago, maybe 20. And I encountered Buddhism, particularly at Spirit Rock and other places in the Vipassana tradition in the West, and I would read things. And it was really interesting. I don't know about you, but as Sylvia Borstein said, kind of shockingly, one night at Spirit Rock about 10 years ago when I was there, she said, well, what about enlightenment? And it was like a taboo topic. Like, what about enlightenment? You know? And there were lovely teachings. There were beautiful teachings about being calmer and kinder and more at ease with oneself and less harsh and more compassionate and having loving kindness. Those are beautiful teachings. They're wonderful teachings. But they're not the complete liberation from suffering. That's the ultimate aim of practice, in this tradition at least, right? And so, and I think that, and I've heard teachers imply this, that there was a concern, particularly given the kind of neurotic drivenness of Westerners, especially Americans who want to perform and achieve, that if the full heartwood was laid out, I think of it as a mountain kind of guy, you know, the dusty valleys, let's say, are ordinary existence, and then the cooler foothills are the twigs and leaves, right? And then you work your way into the mountains, and then they're the high peaks, and then the very highest peak of all, right? The people who were in the foothills would get frustrated, right? And they would get mad at themselves. And I think out of that fear, there was not a willingness to really name, you know, there really are the snow-capped peaks. It's up to you how far you want to go, but there really are the snow-capped peaks. And it's pretty nice there. The people that hang out there seem really pretty happy, you know. So I think there was a reservation about that. So the trick, I think, and that's the art of practice, is to both, to the extent you can, really, honestly, get a sense that you are already heartwood. You are already Buddha nature, bodhicitta. You are already the kind of spacious arisingness of everything, always. You're already that, infused with caring and presence and kindness and contentment. Already that. To have a growing sense of that and faith in that, that's very important. Confidence, a kind of conviction, like, yeah, that really is how it is. And that I can fall back into that again and again and again, and somehow this invisible net will catch me every time of this, my nature, and the nature of everyone around me, on the one hand. And yet on the other hand, to deal with the fact that we're caught so much of the time by this neurotic inner iguana, baboon, orangutan, you know, the inner orangutan, and caveman, and, you know, personality, right? And how to hold both of those together. And I think that is a lot the art of practice, to keep to both gradually purify and clarify, you know, the inner iguana, right, on the one hand. While on the other hand, you know, helping buoy oneself in the journey through taking refuge in and deepening one's experience of, you know, the fact that you are already heartwood. Yeah, Tom.
You talked about the peaks, the snow-capped peaks as being the epitome of the experience. A couple of weeks ago, you passed out a sutta that we read together. And as I recall, the end of that suggested that the ultimate wasn't the peaks, it was not being anywhere. It was not having to be born again.
Right. I know what you mean.
Is that meaningful, or is that something that we as Westerners kind of kind of pretend doesn't really, isn't really part of the canon?
The short answer is that when you're, like, first of all, the peaks are here inside us right now, and most people have had an intuition, if not actually a real experience of what it's like to have, at least for a moment or two, or an hour or day or week or two, of the mind of no suffering or very, very little suffering. That's available to us. And I think it's quite interesting, actually, that often those moments pass us by because they can be fairly quiet. There's just presence. There's just ongoingness of beingness without disturbance. And yet, if we look back on it, the tranquility in that and the non-contentiousness, you know, the non-struggle, the non-frustration, the non-disappointment is really quite wonderful. It'd be like a really nice place to hang out in. Okay, so I think that, you know, we've had that, number one. Number two, I don't know about you, but, you know, for me there's a range of experience in life, and, you know, when I've had opportunities to really disengage from the neurotic mind and engage and center increasingly, and for me there mainly have been on retreat. Sometimes, you know, like a personal time, just being in the wilderness by myself for the better part of a day. Sometimes it's being in conversation, particularly with people that are, you know, farther along in the practice than we ourselves are, that we get kind of drawn into a state of being that feels really a lot better than kind of the everyday reactive, stressed out state of being. Right? So it's pretty good. It's good. You know, the trick is, of course, to not crave that, right? But just because there are pitfalls along the path doesn't mean we shouldn't keep walking. It just means we should try to sidestep the pitfalls. So all that said, and as the Buddha said himself, you know, the highest happiness is peace. It's this, and he talked about the sublime, the unshakable. I mean, really, it's like it's worth going. It's worth continuing. Okay, all that said, when you're sitting there on the top of the highest mountain, the Mount Everest of practice, at that point there are no longer any conditions present in the Buddhist model that cause any more rebirths. So it's not that a person is avoiding birth, and it's not that there's anything bad per se with birth, it's just that the conditions in the Buddhist model, the cosmology which presumes reincarnation, at least in the traditional Buddhist model, the conditions that cause rebirth no longer exist. I've struggled with this a bit in my mind, and what I've gotten to is that my struggle's irrelevant to where I am working my way up through the foothills and mountains, you know? And that if I get to that point where, in other words, nobody complains about being an arahant, right? That's the fourth stage of enlightenment. You know, people don't complain about stream entry in Buddhism. Oh, darn, I'm a stream enterer. What a bummer. Now that I've entered this stream, bummer. You know, it's practice is rewarding, generally speaking. So that's, is that clear? Maybe no. It's not so much that we should seek. The Buddha was clear. We don't. There are three kinds of desires. You know, there's the desires for basically things to arise, continue, and fall away. And so the desire, and all three of those can get us in trouble. The desire for an ending, for nothingness, for nullness, you know, is nihilism in Buddhism, and the Buddha rejected that view. You know. That said, it's interesting that I think it's useful to come to terms with the nature of the road you're on, the path you're on, and have some kind of faith in I'm moving toward those snowy peaks, and the moments that I experience that the peaks are already here are good moments. I think it helps to have some sense of confidence in the path. But then at the point you have enough, focus on the next step. Focus on the next step, in the next 30 seconds. Most of us have a lot of work to do, me included, in the next 30 seconds. You know what your work is, you know, right? Just go home and visit your relatives. or turn on some political figure you don't like. You know, it's worked against. Okay. Others. Yeah, right there.
I want to get back to the steps about recognizing the craving, the suffering, the desire. And what were those steps again? Something came up with me, and I thought it was more. I was thinking about a moment of upset, and I realized that I was trying to be in control of the situation, and that was causing suffering.
Yeah.
So it was a desire for control, but I didn't hear the part about what those steps to recognize.
That's wonderful. So may we, can we use that example a little bit? And so desire for control. And I think often related to that are desires to be right, or a desire to be one up, or to prevent being one down. Can you recognize those? Okay. All right, good. Just check. Well, that's good. Actually, some people like, they go, what do you mean, one up, one down? I'm like, okay, we've got some foothills to work our way through. Right there, mountaintop, that kind of recognition. That's another really important point. A lot of the time, we're honestly transported to the highest peaks. A moment of insight, you're at the highest peaks. You know, really.
Are you sure about that?
Well, the Buddha said so, but yeah, when you recognize it right there, the recognition we have when we recognize, oh yeah, wanting to or hating being one down, you know, or liking being one up, or liking having the last word, whatever, that recognition, oh, that's there in my mind, that's the same recognition a Buddha has, but it doesn't arise in a Buddha's mind. But a Fumbun is very mature in practice. It's the same recognition. Oh, there, yet again, it's my BS. You know, there I go again. You know, the number is arising again. Observing is observing wherever you are. Right there is a good example of right there. You're on top of you're at the mountain. So that's it. Control. Okay? So now let's work our way through, kind of quickly, the gratification, the danger, and the escape, and the practices. That's what you're asking for, right? So control, first off, feel the pleasure in control. Whatever it is, and this is where actually it's actually very useful to open up to the dark side, right? Feel it. A lot of times we don't let ourselves feel it, right? Feel this pleasure. What's the pleasure in control, you know? And then you feel into it. Oh, like I can totally go there. Like control in a situation or people or having control over.
I realize it's also a fear of something falling apart.
Okay, very good. That's a key point there. So there are positive desires or rewards and then negative rewards. In other words, the presence of the plus and the absence of the minus. Right? So control, in part, in psychological language, is a defense against feeling like things are going to fall apart, which then often takes you to the dreaded experience, the feared experience, the dreaded experience. What would I feel if things completely fell apart? And that often can take us to very young material. Like, you know, a very young state of mind, which is of just disorganization and despair. Right? If you can get a sense of that.
Or worse.
Or worse. Yeah, or worse. So, great. So then you think, okay, the gratification is I'm avoiding disaster one more time, right? I'm preventing something bad, or I'm getting some pleasures of various kinds related to control. So by being aware of the gratification, interestingly, paradoxically, by opening up to it, it starts losing its power. Sometimes also when we're aware of the gratification, we become aware of a kind of subpersonality inside the mind. You know, the controller, right? Or the one who is terrified of chaos or flow, right? Or others having power. Because maybe growing up, when others had power, bad things happened, right? So you become aware of these subpersonalities, and actually, oddly, if you open up to listening to them, they lose their power. That's one. Another aspect of practicing with the gratification is to realize that a lot of the gratification is anticipatory, not actual. And that is really, really skillful. That's really useful to do. In other words, we anticipate pleasure, or we anticipate the avoidance of pain. But in fact, when we get to the pleasure, is it actually that good? You know, like when you imagine getting a blouse or a shirt at the mall, you know, a Gap, you think, what a nice thing to get. And then you actually buy it, and then you wear it. How long does that pleasure actually last, and how intense is it? Sometimes it's really cool, right? But often, within a few minutes, you're not thinking about the t-shirt or sweater or jacket anymore. It doesn't... Yeah, you want the next one. Right, desire goes again. So you start looking and realizing that the gratification isn't so great. Right? That's very... And that is actually related to the Buddhist notion of disenchantment. You start seeing through. And you start realizing that in the inner simulator, you know, where the mini-movies are, they're kind of hyping the rewards that will come from doing various things. It's kind of like the movie is never as good as the trailer, right? There are a lot of inner trailers running, like it'll be like this if I do that, or a lot of it's interactively. A lot of the desires that get us in trouble are micro-desires in moments of interaction with others. You know, and we anticipate, oh, if I let it go this way, it'll feel horrible. Well, actually, it usually rarely feels horrible. Maybe it did as a kid, but as an adult, it doesn't. Or on the other hand, we think to ourselves, you know, if I make sure it goes this way, it'll feel really sweet. Does it actually? Okay. So that's good practice around the gratification. And there are others, but that's good practice. And then seeing the danger. That's where you tell the truth to yourself about the payoff. I said it badly. Another way to do it with gratification is to ask yourself, what's the payoff? What am I getting out of this? What's the strategic point? Including what's the experience, the dreaded experience that I'm trying to avert through this way of being, the strategy here, this little program I'm running, okay? In terms of the danger, you ask yourself not what's the payoff, but rather what's the price? What's this cost me? And then you slow it down. And often again, people defend against really experiencing what the cost is, because they just don't want to, they're afraid of feeling it. And that's where sometimes it's skillful to bring in resources, either external resources like a therapist or a friend or a trusted person, or in particular, inner resources of a felt sense of being cared about by others and valued and cherished by others, which is a very strong way to build, to activate those approaching system neural networks, which then become resources and resource states that help us deal with our fear of really feeling what it costs us to pursue the desires that get us in trouble. So we take inventory. I forget which step that is in AA, where you take, I love the phrase, a searching and fearless inventory. Is that the languaging? Searching and fearless. Isn't that so much, such dignity in that as well? And that, so you want to help yourself face the dangers. You know, and one way to do that is to feel the dignity in a searching and fearless inventory of what it's cost you and others to pursue the desires that get you in trouble. Okay? And then the escape. Now we're onto the really good stuff. And there are a lot of ways to escape. There are different practices. one practice is obviously prior gratitude in fullness. You know, another is to simply not act out the desire. Just don't act it out. You know, just be disciplined about it and see what happens and see that it actually turns out okay. Another one is to really pop out to a very big sense of spaciousness. You know, a big picture, like a bird's eye view, that really can help us escape from the desire. Because so many of these desires, isn't it really true? Like, for example, haven't you had the experience where you really, really wanted something that you knew wasn't really good for you, but too bad, you didn't give a darn, you're going to go after it anyway? And yet you just couldn't do it, right? Whatever it was. You know, you couldn't get them on the phone to yell at them, or you couldn't find any drugs in your house, or any cookies in the cupboard, or whatever it was, or and so forth. And then when you're all done with that whole trajectory, that whole cascade, you wake up the next morning or you go to bed that night and you just think to yourself, I feel so much better that I didn't do that. Right? It's almost like we get hypnotized or enchanted by these desire cascades. So often when we take this really big picture, it helps us appreciate, wow, that just doesn't do that much for me after all. Okay. So that there are other methods as well, you know, in terms of the escape. But
it sounds as though they're kind of interrelated. They're part of the methods kind of overlap, or they're kind of segments of them that could be part of it.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah. Okay. And then the Buddha also really talked about replacing unwholesome desires with wholesome ones. That's another way to escape. What's the alternative to that? So, for example, in terms of things like the hindrances, you know, the antidote to anger is kindness. You know, right? The antidote to my own personal antidote to greed is gratitude and gladness, right? And feeling already full. Another escape, one more really key escape, is relaxing selfing. Relaxing selfing. What I mean by that is that if you watch your own mind, when the desire occurs, very often the sense of I grows behind it. First there is the desire. First there is the pleasant or the anticipated pleasant. Okay? Then comes the desire, the craving. This is the Buddha's analysis of contact, the stimulus, and then the feeling of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and then the craving, and then the clinging, which gets really big. You know, that's the desire, right? Okay? So you think of something, and then you desire it, and then you can watch on the heels of that this growing sense of I. Mm-hmm. You can really watch the growing sense of I, and the story of I, and mine, and me, and who I am, and how dare you treat me that way, and very self-referential emotions like embarrassment, right, or pride, or grandiosity, or, you know, vanity, and all the rest of that, okay? You can watch that, right? You can see self grow, which helps you appreciate its dynamic nature, which is a great way to increasingly disidentify from self. Self is just one more content in mind. It's okay that it arises. The problem is that we privilege it and identify with it. We say that's the me-est of me. The thought of me is the most me of all, right? But if we also, as we observe selfing, work on stepping back and relaxing that sense of I into a more global sense of personness that's moving through time as a process, if we relax that sense of I and get less caught up in it, and it, just name it, oh, a lot of I here, a lot of self here, a lot of me, a lot of Rick here, whatever, right? Or your own name. Use your name, not mine. No. You see, if you're, you know... It's really funny, isn't it? I'll just be doing mispractice, and I'll be going, wow, there's a lot of Tom there. Wait, that's wrong. That's psychotic. You're there, I'm here. Okay. Doing that undermines desires. It's a great way to also promote the escape, to relax the self around it. Okay, thanks. All right, Betsy.
I'm thinking of the suffering, craving, and desires, and I'm going to go backwards, that going from the I to the we is very helpful, and the meditation really helps, because you know that you're not, you know, all the molecules, et cetera, go. I mean, we're all one, or you can feel that. Yeah. And the gratitude helps, so that you don't have that sense of I, which is critical in selfing, or not selfing. But to talk about the, so that's the end, but the craving, you know, to have a drink, and you suffer when you crave it. You think about it, I suppose you could use food or working on a computer, and then you take the drink, and you think you have, that it's nice. But after the first sip, it's really not what you think it is. But so you keep having it so you can feel the feeling that you want to have. So you've got your craving, you think you've satisfied it, now you no longer, I forget how you put it, but you, right. You know, so the end of suffering is to not do that anymore. And that can be really difficult. But when you finally do that, a whole different world opens up. So the meditation changes, and the I being the we gets even bigger and better. I'm not sure if I'm saying this right.
Great. Yeah.
But there's that craving, and there's the taking it, which is the suffering, and the end of suffering is stopping it and using all the tools we have here. So I'm just really grateful that I know about craving, suffering, and the end of suffering, because otherwise I wouldn't know that it would be okay. But it's really true.
Thank you. That's
great. I'm glad you've been using this past few weeks.
Yeah, you said it super well. Thank you. Okay, others? Yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the exciting things for me has been to sit with it, just observe and witness what's going on. Ah, all this craving, all this lusting, all the craving and lusting, and just sit with it and not judge it, not be critical, just be in a really compassionate place in the watching and seeing what's underneath it. Oh, lots of longing. Okay,
yeah.
Lots of what's going on a much deeper level. And that's been kind of like a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, to go really, really deep.
Great.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's been wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, great.
One thing that's helped me particularly, well, somewhat with the desire to control, but it's definitely still there.
Uh-huh.
I've got a lot of practice with that one, but is to kind of remember that, like all our negatives, there's some positive on that spectrum, and sometimes being in controller can bring good things if it's directed in the right way and you're doing a good project and it works out. So kind of it helps to be able to, I think what was just said about sitting with it,
yeah,
we remember that it's not all negative, with some desires.
Yes.
That there's a positive aspect.
Yeah, that's right. There are many desires that are wholesome, right?
Like,
or they're mixed together. You know, it's a mix. It's like a goulash, you know, mixed pickles, as they say in Germany. Yeah, and sorting out the one from the other is useful. That's great. Yeah, Tom?
Somehow I've been reflecting upon Eckhart Tolle's work as we've been talking, and his reference to the pain body. And my understanding is that the way he presents it is that this pain body is just always there. And through various mechanisms, like staying in the moment, I can shrink it. But it's always just like hanging over me and floating around it, like a balloon.
Uh-huh.
Like I'm carrying a helium balloon.
Huh.
And I just wanted you to comment on that in terms of Buddhist psychology and just comparing that point of view, that it's always with us. Because my understanding, being a beginner in Buddhism, is that Four Noble Truths give us the hope that, you know, that balloon will burst, that's not the case, that suffering is always going to be with us. It's the understanding of craving that will, and doing something about it, that will lead us to total liberation.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. So I don't know Eckhart Tolle's notion of the pain body particularly. I can imagine what I think he means. How much of it is a metaphor for something that's really psychological, albeit woven into the body in some sense, and how much of it is he's talking about something as a like an etheric energy field, and that's what he means. I don't know, or maybe both. I don't know. In Buddhism is the notion of dukkha. Dukkha is translated as stress or strain, unsatisfactoriness. Sometimes it's translated as suffering. In English, the word suffering tends to mean extremes of physical or emotional pain. And whereas most of the dukkha the Buddha was talking about is much milder,
okay,
and subtler and more in the background. The meaning of the word dukkha is very instructive. It means sort of maladaptive. or, you know, rocky, or, you know, not right, yuck, yucky. That's de. Ka is where an axle meets the hub of a wheel. In other words, dukkha is a wobbly grinding. It's, you know, where the axle and the wheel are not perfectly balanced, so there's a kind of grinding and wobbliness. And to me, doesn't, I don't know about you, that's just, I get it right there. Okay, I get it. And the first noble truth is the pervasiveness of dukkha. It's not that life is only dukkha, right? It's just that there's a lot of dukkha, right? And then the Buddha distinguished, and this is an important distinction, between the inevitable pain and discomfort that's part of human existence, which includes, among other pains and discomforts, old age, disease, and death, right, as the classic ones. But on the other hand, there is a lot of dukkha just woven into everyday experience. We often don't notice it, but it's there. It's a subtle sense of unease, or not being balanced, or a subtle background distress, or honestly, the residues and emotional memory of the sorrows of this life, going way back even before we can have any conscious recall of what those were, you know, before age 3 or so. Right? There's, and I think there might be some of that emotional, yeah, the pain body, just the residues. And as a, honestly, as someone who's really pushed it hard about what can be done in neuropsychology and what the promise possibly is, I don't think you can get rid of all of it. I think it's hopeless. I think the construction of dukkha, part of which is social, it's also social. It isn't just you and your mom and dad and big brother and little sister and, right? It's gender, it's culture, it's race, it's oppression, it's subtle messages, it's capitalism, it's, you know, it's the whole thing, right? And I just don't think anyone can ever, I don't care who you are, practice hard enough to pull all those weeds, which has a lot of implications for ultimately taking your home in the heartwood that's always already present. Because you can't get to liberation by just relentlessly pulling out all the engrams. You know, the engram is a notion from L. Ron Hubbard in Scientology, which is actually a great notion, even though he was a paranoid, psychotic person, you know, of these residues of pain, you know, of upset. Yeah, I don't think you can pull out all the engrams. So there's the bottom line is there's an inherent atmospheric dukkha, as well as just dealing with life and other people and bumps and bruises. And people do stuff. It's irritating. And, you know, there you are with them, or they worry you, or you worry about your kids, or the state of the economy. What's going to happen in the midterm elections in a couple of months? Okay, and here's the interesting thing. Much of our suffering is a reaction to dukkha. Dukkha, it's called.
Dukkha,
right? Part of one example of that is where, for example, we get mad that we're hurt, right? We're angry that we're suffering. We get upset that we're suffering yet again, right? We get irritated with ourselves that we feel embarrassed about public speaking, okay? Dukkha. But more broadly than that, it's very interesting. If you feel the dukkha, you feel this unsatisfactoriness, or let's say the tension between you and another person, or the stress, my experience again and again, and I bet it's yours too, is that when you really open up to that dukkha in a spaciously mindful way, it stops being dukkha. It's just sensation. It's very, very curious. It's maybe it's pain, but it's not suffering. There's no wobbly grinding. There's suddenly you're out of the wobbly grinding mode, and just what's there is there. So, the ultimate freedom from dukkha is no more birth. That is part of what I think the Buddha meant. and that goes to Tom's point, that that is, in his view, he said, I teach one thing, suffering in its end. Okay? And you don't have to get into that. But if you're into the end of suffering, for the Buddha that meant no more births.
Is it required birth, or is it just birth?
Say that again?
Is it required birth?
To what?
Required birth.
The end of suffering.
Does it? You have to take birth to not suffer? You mean to work it through?
Right.
Is that what you mean?
Well, actually, I'm almost confused myself here.
Okay.
If the end of suffering is no more births, a Buddha sattva can be born again, but not be required to be born.
Okay. Let me do that next, and then we'll wrap up tonight. And maybe we should have another free-for-all next week. Does that feel right to you?
Yeah.
Rather than me impose some kind of talk on this very, I think, wonderfully luscious and fruitful conversation. And about this stuff, you have to see for yourself, the more you look into your own experience. But something that I think, the Buddha's view was that suffering is inherent in existence. You know, even in heaven realms, there are subtle forms of suffering. Okay? In his view. You don't have to buy that. So there is a way in which, and I think it doesn't get talked a lot about because it's troubling for people to think about, but there is a way in which that in the Buddhist model is a recognition that if you're interested in the ultimate non-suffering, it does involve an ultimate release of even the most subtle sense of I that would care to be born again. Now, for me at least, it's been helpful for me to understand that. And that said, to drop it and focus on the next step, the next 30 seconds of practice, because that's where the action really is. And it's easy to get very caught up in this stuff. So I want to say it, because I think it's useful, for me at least, to have a sense of clarity about practice. Now, if you practice in order to not exist, that's a trap. That's the trap of nihilism. What we practice for is the next step. It's just the case that in the Buddhist view, the causes and conditions that lead to rebirth gradually become undone. And ultimately, with nirvana, they're blown out, because that's what nirvana means, to blow out, to extinguish like a flame. You know, the metaphor that's often used is a flame passed from candle to candle to candle. All right, that's tendency. So flaming is very processual. It's very much a process. Okay, is it the same flame in the second candle that it was in the first one? Do you get this sense of it? And again, don't get too into the head about it. But ultimately, when there's no longer wax and wick, all eddies disperse eventually, right? Like that. That's the idea. And so that is one way that suffering ends. We don't take birth anymore in flesh that must experience pain that's physical and emotional, because we're emotional and social, profoundly social animals. Okay. The other way that suffering ends is here and now, where we radically eliminate and transcend the causes of our suffering. In other words, the craving, the anger, the contentiousness, the greed, the delusion that leads to suffering. And also, this is my point, I mean, kind of getting at, we relate to dukkha in a very different way. In other words, we reduce the causes of dukkha, and when dukkha is there, we relate to it differently. We don't create dukkha-dukkha. And even more fundamentally, when we're present with the dukkha that's there, very curiously, it de-dukkifies. It's like the dukkiness of it somehow starts moving around and becoming different and letting go. And it's just sensation. It's just thought. It's just, that's it. The bodhisattva idea was, in Buddhism, came centuries after the Buddha's life. And the basic idea, which many of you already know, is the idea of a being who could, in principle, tip into such complete awakening that all the causes of rebirth fall away. But instead, out of boundless compassion for all beings, gives up his or her own utter fulfillment, you know, the most sublime peace, gives that up for the sake of hanging out, birth after birth, to help bring other people across the river of suffering. Mm-hmm. That's the notion of the bodhisattva. And in the Mahayana wing of Buddhism, it's seen as the highest value. And, you know, then there are conversations about that. I think two things about that to wrap up, okay? One thing, one way to look at that is that it's a noble ideal, and that said, particularly in the real meaning of it, okay? And that means a bodhisattva is someone who's basically a realized being, okay? Until you're a realized being, take the next step. You know, practice with the next 30 seconds. Okay. The other thing that I think is really cool to imagine, if this is not going to take you too far afield, it relates to something that a friend of mine who was a monk in Thailand for 9 years said to me. He's now a massage therapist in Grand Forks, North Dakota. You never know who's going to be rubbing your back, you know. But anyway, and he said, you know, the truth is, lots of people that are in really fairly mature stages of practice, actually, deep, deep down, and who are working something out in this life, don't realize that they're actually already in a pretty far along state of practice. Yeah? In other words, it's possible that you may already be really quite far along in your deepest nature in practice, even to the point of being a stream enterer, which in Buddhism is the first of the four stages of awakening, when you have supposedly just seven lives left. You might be in your fourth life as a stream enterer, or next to last one, who knows, you know, or the first one, or tipping increasingly there, or actually have some kind of inner emergent bodhisattvaness that's animating you and living in you like a plant underneath the surface that's trying to send its green shoots up to the light, living out into your day-to-day life. And I just think that's quite a lovely idea, to imagine giving oneself over increasingly to that, you know, inner heartwood.
Claiming it.
Yeah, claiming it and honoring it, you know, feeling like there's been, I do this practice, like there's been a handoff to you. You know, think of all the previous moments of you in this physical life, who knows, perhaps other lives prior to it, handed off to get you to this place of practice today. You know, it's for me, I don't want to drop the baton, right? You know, I want to do what I can to hand it off to the next hour or minute or life. So you might want to think about that, that inner unfolding in you. So let's take a last minute and we'll sit and then we'll wrap up. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you.
Thank you.